So you, I didn't mention it last week, but you've probably figured out that we're not reading Galatians anymore. We're in Colossians. We started the book, the letter to the church in Colossae last Sunday, and now we got the second half of chapter 1 today. And I always recommend that you read at home the whole book or the whole letter to get some sense of where things how the things fit together. These were not designed to be broken up and presented over weeks and weeks' time. And in fact, we never get all of the book or all of the letter read in church anyways. So do that. Read it at least once. Maybe read it once or twice a week or once or twice a day. It's quite short. And you'll get a sense for how the book hangs together and what some of the themes are. So last week I said, Paul wants to stress the need for true knowledge, authentic knowledge, which is a knowledge that comes out of encounter, a knowledge of God, not just a knowledge about God. We need to be able to live the truths that we claim, and we need to in order for them to fulfill their purpose and intent. Your truth is always useless if it isn't translated into behavior or action, right? If you know something true and you don't act on it, then that knowledge is pretty useless. So anyway, that was last week. Paul continues. If you had read all of Colossians and were familiar with the overview of the book, you would know that Paul is continuing to stress what he thinks is of chief importance. And we could ask ourselves, well, Paul, what is the one thing that you think is important to know? First of all, you said it's important. Here's the one thing the church needs is this knowledge, true knowledge, authentic knowledge, knowledge based on encounter. What is it that we should know? And if you had read Colossians through, you would know that he's already answering the issues and the problems that he's trying to address for the church in Colossians. And that is, his answer is, Jesus Christ, period. Full stop, nothing added, nothing taken away. That's what you need to know, Jesus Christ. Period. So it's a little bit like if you've been around, you know, teaching Sunday school or in the ministry, children who go to church in Sunday school somehow know that Jesus is always the right answer, even if the question doesn't make sense to them. Like, okay, who turned out the lights? Jesus? Yeah, because Jesus is always the right answer, right? So, but in this case, it's true. Jesus is always the right answer. Now, what it means or how he's the right answer, that's not always clear. But Paul is very clear here. You don't need anything besides Jesus. You don't need more. Because the church in Colossae was adapting some teachings that said, now that you've begun with Jesus, you need to add these things. And it's a very important reminder because this idea that we need to add to Jesus or embellish what Jesus has done has stuck with us for 2,000 years. In part because, and again, now I'll probably talk about this more when we work through Colossians, but in part because as humans, we are irreducibly religious creatures. There's something instinctual about humanity that expresses itself in forms of religion. There are no known civilizations that didn't have forms of religion. Also, you know, these all the civilizations that we know of had other sort of common traits. Sociologists and anthropologists both study these sorts of things. Up until the last 100 years or so, where we now have cultures that are atheistic, prior to that, all humanity expressed itself in religious forms. And so there's always this temptation to begin becoming religious with what we know, with our encounter with God. And there's, you know, we can talk more about that at some point. Sometimes that's a form of legalism. Sometimes that's a form of superstition, right? Like carrying a rabbit's foot around. Some people treat a crucifix that way. You see them, you know, potentially hanging off a mirror of a car or whatever. I think the bobblehead Jesus is something else entirely. I'm not sure what that's doing, but so these are the dangers, and Paul says, no, wait a minute. If you remember Jesus, full stop, period, then you would be doing well. As it is, you've forgotten that. And so he begins this passage we heard after he's left off his prayer, his thanksgiving for the church in Colossians, Colossae and the Colossians, and he begins to thank God, and then he says, here's what we pray for you. Then he enters this sort of, most people call this a hymn of praise. They think that Paul is using some already existing traditional material because there's this sort of cadence and rhythm. It sounds like he's reciting a poem, a little bit like if somebody started saying, Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou Romeo? You'd be like, well, you must be quoting something because that doesn't sound like Oz, you know. Good reason it doesn't sound like me. But so we see, it seems like Paul's doing that, which is really quite lovely for us, because Paul, if you're one of these people who says, I really want to know what is the church really taught, because over years the church has sort of maybe lost its way or have a tendency, like I said, this religion always creeps back in. Well, we got Paul, who's like 15, 20 years after the beginning of the church, after the death and resurrection of Jesus, and Paul there is quoting already existing tradition or using already existing tradition. We're getting pretty close to the source, and I think that's great because, as I stressed last Sunday, so this is a reminder and a new thing if you weren't here last Sunday, as I stressed last Sunday, what you know needs to be based on truth. We run the danger of using our experience as a self-warranting, a self-authenticating. So we say to our experience, this is my experience, this must be true, there's no other truth outside of my experience. And that's lovely if your experience is working for you. It's a hell and a sentence of death if your experience is harming you. Because if there's nothing outside of your experience, guess what? You've arrived. You're there. Unless you can change your experience, and the older you get, the less likely that's going to be. I think that's been my experience. Oh, wait a minute, I'm quoting experience. The truth is outside us. Here's the gospel. You can bring your experience in light of truth, and you can ask yourself, if my experience and the truth don't line up, please, God, lead me into truth. And that truth is Jesus Christ, says Paul. That's the thing that's going to open up everything else that's important or necessary. So Paul goes on to say, Jesus was before all things. He created all things. He's the firstborn from the dead, so there might be all things in all things. He's the image of God, and on and on and on. And then he ends with this kind of really kind of crazy statement, I think. Elsewhere, Paul has said, you know, I've been made a minister of this mystery, this revelation in Ephesians. He repeats this. What's the mystery? What's the revelation? The riches of God that are now available to non-Jewish people. That you don't have to be descendant of Abraham and keep the law to enter into the goodness of God and his promises. That's the mystery that's now been revealed, and Paul's a minister of it. And here's how he tells it to the Colossians. It is Christ in you, the hope of glory. Isn't that crazy? Christ in you. Now, probably you collectively, but also you individually. I mean, I think Paul's getting dangerous now. I think he should be more careful. Like, there's all sorts of heresies that you could trot around with, I got Christ in me, why would I need anything else? But it's this lovely, very beautiful reminder that if you want to know what you need to know, it's this: Jesus Christ, period, point, full stop, nothing more needed. That isn't something, as Paul says elsewhere, quoting Moses, misquoting Moses, you know, who the law isn't out there that someone has to go up to heaven to bring it down, or across the sea that someone has to go out there and bring it. It's here, it's within us. The Word of God, that new heart that God promised, a heart of flesh, removing the heart of stone, writing his laws on our hearts. There will be no longer any need for any man to teach any man, any woman to teach any woman. For my law will be written on their hearts. The Lord himself will be their teacher. Christ in you, the hope of glory. So we do add to this, so Jesus Christ, full stop. Why? Because all the fullness of God is in him, all the revelation, all the thing that God intended to do happened in Jesus to reconcile all of creation to himself. And this is the thing that God has done. And when you say yes in faith to what God has done, you now carry within you the very presence and person of God himself in the Holy Spirit, in the person of Christ. John says it in his gospel, if you think Paul's gone a little overboard here. Now, that still leads us with, so here's the thing. Don't get me wrong when I say Jesus Christ, full stop, or even when I say Christ within you, I'm not saying that as if that means, if that explains everything or that gives you somewhere to move or something to do now. It doesn't. You could say, as I would say, if someone was telling me this, what the heck does that mean? Christ in you, the hope of glory. What, is it there next to my pancreas? Like, oh, in my heart. Oh, is that it? Like I've received Jesus into my heart. No. What does this mean, Christ in you, the hope of glory? And I will not answer that for you because I can't answer that for you. Because it is for me a telos, a goal, a lure. It's the carrot on the stick. Right? I'm going along and I'm like struggling and life's bad and hard and I'm like, oh, crap, crap, crap. And then I look up and I'm like, oh, right, Christ. Not just Christ, but Christ in me. Not just Christ in me, the hope of glory. And the crap is still here, but now I'm moving forward. I have a purpose. I have a direction. I have a hope. And this is where I think the gospel is very helpful for us. Christianity sometimes falls into this whole religious trap by trying to give the complete set of answers to the complete set of questions. I do not believe that that was ever God's purpose. You might realize, if you don't, you might remember last week's gospel, where Jesus would answer questions with questions. That's not a way to sort of give a complete set of answers to the complete set of questions now, is it? That's a way to begin a dialogue. That's a way to make an invitation, an encounter. Isn't it? If you ask me a question and I ask you a question, I'm trying to hear from you. I'm not trying to teach you. Right? Why would God respond to humans that way? So the gospel gives us, so anyhow, let me just clarify this. Sometimes when I preach, you know, I'm pushing pretty hard. Please don't mistake that to be a conclusion you draw that I somehow think that I've said everything that needs to be said. If there's anything I try to do when I preach, it's to be that catalyst for your own encounter with God. And I'm trying to invite you into the questions that you should be asking God. When you hear Paul, if you have any reason to take Paul seriously, and he says, Christ in you, the hope of glory, you should just say, what? Why haven't I heard that before? What the heck does that mean? Wow. Slow down, preacher. You hear what Paul, Christ in you, the hope of glory? I can live with that. I mean, I can run with that. I mean, I need to listen. Yeah. So, forgive me when I get in the way of that process. Here's what Mary did. You remember the story. We just heard it. She just sat at the feet of Jesus and listened. And we know that's important because Luke tells us what Martha was doing. Martha, who was distracted. Martha, who, as Jesus says, was anxious. Being distracted because there's stuff to do is one thing. Being anxious is something that you own. And he goes on to say, you're anxious and troubled. And the word for trouble there is the uproar that would happen out in the street when there was a riot because your team just lost the big game. Not the riot that would come when your team won the big game. Jesus says, Martha, Martha, you're anxious and putting yourself in an uproar. Don't complicate Mary in that. In fact, why don't you join us? There's an invitation there with Jesus. It's not a chiding, I don't think. It's not a tisk, tisk, tisk. And neither is it a, well, some of you are Marthas and some of you are Marys. Oh, well, it's not that sort of thing. We're all potentially Marys. If tradition is right, Mary is the same woman who, when Jesus was at dinner in another home with a Pharisee, came in and wept over his feet and washed his feet with her tears and wiped his feet with her hair. And Jesus says, you see this woman whose sins were many, she's been forgiven much and she loves much. And tradition has always told us that Mary is not sitting at the feet of Jesus as a student as much, although she is taking the role of a disciple. As Mary is sitting there, so here's the thing. Do you picture Mary with her notebook going, oh, very interesting. Oh, I like the way you said that, Jesus. Can you spell that for me? Okay, you might think that. I don't see Mary. I see her just kind of looking up and going, wow. There is something here that's going on that I can't put my finger on, but this is exactly where I need to be. And I'm going to soak it in as much as I can. I'm just going to open myself up as much as I can. Not simple-mindedly. Not doe in the headlights, you know, doughy-eyed, deer in the headlights thing. Deliberately, intentionally, loving God. Luke starts this whole section with this command. We heard it last week. Love the Lord your God, heart, soul, mind, body, and strength. Your neighbor is yourself. The lawyer says, who's my neighbor? Jesus tells a story. Who's my neighbor? Luke gives us this story to tell us how the first commandment looks. What does it mean to love God with heart, soul, mind, body, and strength? It means to limit the distractions in your life. To not let yourself be dissipated. Dissipation is a great word. It's usually associated with getting drunk, which you can understand how if you're a little too drunk, then you're probably not going to be very focused. I think that goes hand in hand, right? That's why you're not supposed to drive. But there's many ways you can be dissipated. Being dissipated is just leaving little bits of yourself all over the place. So you got nothing left to give. Being dissipated comes through allowing many, many trivial things or perhaps legitimate obligations and demands based on culture and expectation. Martha has every legitimate right to be distracted. But she could have made the same choice that Mary made. It would have been counterculture, counter stereotype. It would have been counter a lot of things. Jesus Christ, full stop, being. Nothing needed, nothing added. That's not something out there that someone needs to bring near. It's Christ within us, the hope of glory. If that's important at all, then Mary shows us how we can respond. We open ourselves. We say no to those things that trivialize our energy, that distract us, that siphon off our mental energy. And we say yes to the source of life. Paul, you can imagine Paul in this hymn. I imagine him. So Paul would dictate letters. I can imagine Paul walking back and forth and just kind of bouncing on his feet. He's just like, Jesus Christ, in whom all things were made, for whose things all things were made, in whom all things exist. He's the head of the church, his body. And Paul is just like, why would you want more than Jesus? You remember Paul's story. Jesus met him and said, Paul, why are you persecuting me? And that changed everything. That changed everything. And Paul doesn't understand people who come to Jesus and don't know that everything's been changed. You can no longer say, but I'm a woman and I can't sit at the feet of Jesus. You can no longer say, but somebody's got to put the steak on the barbecue and cool the, you know, the Budweiser. You can't say that anymore. Jesus is here. Just, why would you do anything else? Really? Why would you do anything else? Jesus is here.